Hello. I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is being recorded on Yom HaShoah, and it is for that and Shabbat in Israel, Parshat Kedoshim, outside of Israel, Parshat Acharei, formerly known as Acharei Mot, and I guess people tended to shorten it to Acharei because Mot means death. But we'll talk about that a little bit also. Recording, as I said, and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 27th of Nisan, 5779. Last night we counted 12 in the Omer. And it corresponds this year to May 2nd. A few things to take care of first. This is the first Torah Tibbetz audio that I've done in quite a number of weeks. Some of you know and some don't. I won't go into detail, but I was in the hospital for 3 weeks and in a convalescence place for a week. And then I was away for Pesach. And now, hopefully, I'm back in the swing of things. So I apologize for those who looked for Torah Tidbits Audio, and I hope that you're listening now because you didn't give up on me. Special note to Larry and Flo in Baltimore, and Mark in Rochester, he's in Boca now, for asking and being concerned. I appreciate it very much. Next, let's talk about Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah is the short form of the name, the official name of the day. It is Yom HaShoah VeHagvura, a day to mark the Holocaust and courage, strength. We'll talk that very soon. Now let's go in general. The world, or at least what we would refer to as the sympathetic part of the world, sometimes, has accepted the existence of the Shoah and has declared an International Day of Remembrance, which is sometime in the end of January. I don't remember what it corresponds to, if anything. And I guess remembering and reflecting is probably good for the people of the world. For the Jewish people, Yom HaShoah is not just a remembrance day. It is that too. But it is a sad day. It is a mournful day. It has no halachic requirements. It was not made into an official holiday. But nonetheless, it is a very somber day. Here in Israel, food stores, restaurants, etc., and many other places, especially places of entertainment, are closed, at least at night, last night. And some places open today and some don't. There is a siren that is sounded across the country at 10 o'clock in the morning. And with a couple of exceptions, including sad exceptions, most people respond to it by standing still and quiet and having 2 minutes of reflection. But it's a sad day. But there's more. And this is sort of a new thought for me. I'll give you the background of it first, which is not new. I'll add what I came up with yesterday or the other day. The early founders of the State of Israel, especially the younger crowd, were extremely proud of the fact that they were living in Israel, that they had a government, that they have an army, which, thank God, and definitely thank God, has been successful, because every war that we have been in has been a war of existence. And when they reflected on the extremely unimaginable tragic events of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, it was very difficult to imagine Jews without a state, without an army, and to be slaughtered in the huge numbers that took place during the Holocaust. So when it came time to mark it, there was a suggestion, a good suggestion, that it be incorporated into Tisha B'Av, that it piggyback with Tisha B'Av as a day of national mourning, which would also put on the list, unfortunately we have a long list, of tragedies to mourn. And, in fact, two of the lamentations, maybe more than two, have been written. Many people add them at the end of the reciting of the keynote in the morning for the Shoah. Others said, and this is also official here, that Asara B'Tevet, the 10th of Tevet, became, in addition to whatever else it commemorates, a Yom Kaddish Klali, a general Kaddish day for those who perished in the Holocaust without family to follow them, without anyone to say Kaddish for them, without anyone to mark a Yahrzeit for them, without knowing who they were and where they were and where they're buried, if they are, and what happened to them. And as impressive as it is that Yad Vashem has over 3 million names of victims of the Holocaust, they're missing over 300 names, 3 million names. Did I say million before? 3 million names they know, which is a phenomenal task, and it's been built up over the last 50-plus years, make it 70 years. And there's still so many, many more. So the Knesset with the rabbinate, or the rabbinate with the backing of the Knesset, declared Asara B'Tevet as a Yom Kaddish Klali. And it's a very sober and sad reminder. And it's also good that we are able to say a Kaddish, not for a parent, but for people unknown who are our brothers and sisters just the same. In any event, there was a feeling in the early years of the state that commemorating the Holocaust was not enough. They needed also to reflect in the day the acts of resistance and rebellion, successful or not. Sadly, most were not. And add that aspect to just the plain sadness of the tragedy. So the day became Yom HaShoah HaGvura, and it was pinned on the 27th of Nisan, today, which is the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. For the people who established this, and for all of us, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising represented the fact that we were not merely lambs who were taken to slaughter and passively killed, but there was resistance. This was not the only example of it, but it was the famous example. And it allows you to both bow your head in somber remembrance and in mourning, and then lift your head with a certain pride in the Jewish spirit. Now, I will add to this two thoughts. One, aside from armed resistance, which we'll call a physical resistance, there was also a spiritual strength, courage, and resistance. There is a book in English that has been condensed from 5 volumes in Hebrew, written by Rabbi Ephraim Oshri, who survived the Holocaust and lived into his 90s, I believe. And he had written, he was a rabbi, a young rabbi, in the Kovno ghetto. And he recorded the questions and answers that he was asked over the period of the ghetto's existence, and then subsequently as well. All Holocaust-related questions. Among other things, and just to give an example or two, he speaks of a secret minyan. Jews gathering together in a basement someplace at the risk of their lives to have tefillah b'tzibur. That by itself is an act of defiance and courage, because every Jew in the situation of the Holocaust had clear halachic exemption from all of those kind of mitzvot, and yet the stubbornness, tenacity, boldness, courageousness of the Jewish soul resulted in secret minyanim and secret learning groups. So Rabbi Oshri tells one little episode where the chazan, the shaliach tzibur, got up in the beginning to say brachot out loud, birchot hashachar, and when he got to the blessing that ends shelo osani eved ovid, who has not made me a slave, he couldn't say it. He broke down crying, and he turned to the rabbi and said, how can we possibly say this blessing when we're slaves and worse? The rabbi's answer was that we are physically enslaved and to a sad extent doomed, but not our spirit. Our spirit is in full vitality, and I'm adding, this existence of a minyan is proof of it. Another question and answer he had there. He always usually starts with a story. There were a group of men who worked outside the ghetto for the Nazis in a construction site. And they managed to steal a number of boards and bring them back into the ghetto and hide them. When it came time for the holiday of Sukkot, they found an abandoned alleyway and constructed a sukkah. Then they realized there might be a problem with that. What problem? You don't have to risk your life to do sukkah. That wasn't their problem. They were doing it. And that was gevura. That was strength, courage, and resistance. So what was their question? Can you fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah with stolen boards? The rabbi, instead of telling them the equivalent of, what are you guys, out of your mind? You're risking your lives for a mitzvah that you're clearly not required to put your life at risk. You're exempt. He didn't say that to them. He took their question based on their courage to keep their spirits alive, and he told them that since the Nazis did not bring lumber with them from Germany to Kovno, they obviously took over the local lumber yards, which were owned many by Jews. And there is a halachic concept called Yiyush Ba'alim, when you steal something from a person and the person holds out hope of its return, then the object always has to be returned, and it's always considered stealing, stolen. But when it is clear that the owner, original owner, gave up all hope, and that was definitely the case, Rabbi Oshri said about the situation that they were facing, he told them halachically, no objection, and they proceeded to fulfill the mitzvah. Turns out, he adds as a subsequent comment, that there was a roundup from which they were missing because they were in this alleyway and the Nazis couldn't find them. And had they not been in the sukkah, they probably would have been sent to their deaths. I could go on and on, but I want to talk about other things. And it's just an amazing legacy of courage that to me warrants calling this Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura. And as much as we need to focus on the Shoah part, we also need to see the indomitable, if that's the word, Jewish spirit, which has kept us alive through the years. Another point. Tisha B'Av is sort of like this a little. Tisha B'Av is the saddest day of the year. Commemorates the destruction of the two Batei Mikdash, the two temples, and a bunch of other calamities and tragedies that are attached to it, like the Inquisitions, like Crusades, and other things. And yet, towards the end of Tisha B'Av, actually only three quarters of the way through, we hit the afternoon of Tisha B'Av. Most restrictions of the day continue. However, lights in the shul that had been dimmed the night before go on full power. Coverings that were removed from the Holy Ark and the Shulchan, the table from which the Torah is read, which were removed, are restored. People are allowed to sit on chairs rather than on the ground. And the day changes from that super sad day to a sad day, a fast day, a serious day. But at Mincha, we add Nachem. Be comforted. And if it were totally, totally black, without shining the light at the end of the tunnel, we might fall into a despair from which we can't recover. But the day sort of goes low, and then a little flip up, followed by Shabbat Nachamu, and followed by a period where you can't say the morning is over. It isn't. It continues, but on a low key. There are elements of mourning, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, that go all year round. There are elements that go as reminders of the Holocaust all year round also, especially in our day and age when survivors still are around. I was talking to one of my daughters this morning who said, my children, when they have children, probably won't have too many survivors to introduce them to and to listen to their stories. So it's very important that this stay alive and in perspective. I had another thought, but we'll have to leave it because I don't remember it. It just slipped out of my mind. If I think about it, I'll let you know. Okay, I remembered and it hit me as a jolt. Let's take a look first at Haman from the Purim story and Hitler, Yimach Shemam. Haman planned on destroying every man, woman, and child of the Jewish people. for no good reason other than he was annoyed at Mordechai for not bowing down to him, and annoyed that the people in the palace's courtyard taunted him about it. Destroy every man, woman, and child. Go couple of thousand years later, and we're dealing with another Haman whose desire was to destroy every Jew, man, woman, and child. And that has happened between the original Amalek and the Haman and Hitler in many different ways. But those are two examples that I'm choosing because of how different the results were. Haman was totally unsuccessful in his attempt. His plot was revealed almost a year before it was supposed to take place. He was hanged. Subsequently, his 10 sons were hanged, and the Jewish people in the kingdom were given permission to fight for themselves on that day of the original plot plan, which was right before our Purim. And we celebrate it. But you can't ever forget what Haman's intention was. And it probably took a different kind of toll because there was that year, almost a year, where Ahasuerus refused to cancel the decree against the Jewish people. Because what can you do? A king's decree has to stay. Which is nonsense, because the King of Kings, God, cancels his decrees all the time, depending upon the behavior of the people. But that was Haman. Hitler, sadly, tragically, unspeakably, was partially successful. And to say that the deaths of 6 million, which is probably, according to recent research, over 7 million, I'm not at all trying to trivialize that and the scars that it left on the survivors. But he also did not succeed in wiping out the Jewish people. The final solution failed at great cost to us. And for that, we have to chalk it up to God's choice. I know that's too simplified to say, but that's all I could say about it now. Now carry it a little further. Since then, and even to this very day, there has been ups and downs in anti-Semitism around the world. The incidents that you hear about are certainly on a micro scale compared to the mega scale of the Shoah, but how different are they? When my mother, Aleha Shalom, in the States, went out collecting money to help get arms for Israel in the beginning of the statehood, beginning of the War of Independence, a guy came up to her and said, "Why should I help Israel? They're a Jewish people, and Hitler had the right idea, and he just didn't succeed. They should all go to hell." And we hear that today. We hear it today. The shooting in near San Diego in the Chabad Shul, the guy was heard to have said, "Jews should all go to hell, and I'm going to help them." So that exists. Amalek, Haman, Hitler, and everybody since and in between are sadly alive, if not well, today. And that's something that we can't forget. So if there was a suggestion, which there was, of tagging the Shoah onto Tisha B'Av, we should have no problem in tagging the rampant anti-Semitism around the world to a day like Yom HaShoah and Tisha B'Av and any other day we so choose. And I believe that's something to keep in mind. Once upon a time, this Torah Tibbetz audio when Arut Sheva was still on the radio, was broadcast live. So when I said something on a Thursday night, I was talking to people who were listening on a Thursday night. Now, because of the time difference in the state, I am talking in the afternoon of Thursday. That's specifically 3:15 in the afternoon, which is 6:45 in the morning in New York, let's say, and even earlier elsewhere in the states, and later, whatever, of where else I'm listened to, which happens to be from a lot of different countries, which is very nice to hear about, and both by Jews and non-Jews. In any event, there will be some people listening in the context of Yom HaShoah. For those who are listening to this after, on Friday, or on Sunday, or later, it's out of context, and I'm sorry if I came down heavy, but right now it's in the middle of Yom HaShoah for me, for us, for all of us. The book that I referred to before, I forgot to name, by Ephraim Ushri, is called Responsa from the Holocaust. There are other versions of it from different people with maybe a slightly different name. They're all valuable to read. I remember many years ago, I think it's out of print now, but you have to look. Many years ago when I bought the book in a bookshop here in Yerushalayim, I got on a bus and I started to read it. And I started to cry uncontrollably. People were worried about me. And I calmed down. And then, subsequently, I reread some of the things that I had read. And I choked up again. For years, I was reading one particular passage in the book, which I didn't mention before and I'll mention now, about a man who was deported to the Kovno ghetto, and he decided to make it his task to steal flour, little bit at a time, and sneak it into the ghetto, which was against the law, against the Nazi law, and save it up so that matzah could be baked for Pesach, and some people would be able to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. He did this many times, and on his last time, he was searched extra diligently, and he was found with it, and he was beaten to within an inch of his life, including all of his teeth broken. And he had accumulated, unknown to the Nazis, enough flour to produce enough matzah for 100 people to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of eating one kazayit piece. And he went to the rabbi with tears, and he said, I risked my life so many times for this, and I'm not even going to be able to eat this matzah because I have no teeth. And the rabbi said, you can soak it in water and soften it. And he said, no, I can't. I come from a Hasidic background, and I don't eat matzah shruya, gebrocht, soaked matzah. I'm getting choked up about it now. Years and years I've read this and reread it. Had an episode once where I went into Rabbi Zeflef's class towards the end on a Yom HaShoah, and I read this out loud to a full auditorium, and I started crying in the middle, and I handed him the book to finish the story, and he went, oh no, you finish the story, which I did, but it took a long time. Anyway, the Rav convened a Beit Din, and they did a Hatarat Nedarim, nullification of vows, because a long-standing minhag by somebody, custom, is considered tantamount to a vow. And they permitted, under the circumstances, his eating of soaked matzah shruya. Remarkable remarkable show of gevura. He could have gone to the rabbi and said, "Where is God? I risked my life over and over again so that my fellow Jews would be able to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah on Pesach. And this is what he does?" He didn't say a word like that. Didn't complain a word. He accepted his fate. And all he wanted to know was how he could eat that matzah without his teeth. Remarkable. He did not survive. But he did provide people, not just with a kazayat of matzah, but with the courage to continue with their courageous spirituality and refusal to give up on that aspect of their being and their Jewishness, even on the most dire of straits. I think I have said my piece, and I hope that it went not just from my mouth to your ear, but from my heart to your heart. I want to change the topic abruptly. Now would be a good time to turn off the tape and go wash the dishes and then come back, unless you're washing the dishes while you're listening, because the tone is changing abruptly. We have a situation this year, which happens not unusually, of Pesach being Shabbat through Friday here in Israel, and Shabbat through Shabbat with the extra day outside of Israel. On the Shabbat following the 7 days of Pesach, we cannot yet eat chametz, still eating on our Pesach dishes and preparing for that Shabbat with Pesach pots and pans and cutlery and the Shabbat and eating matzah. For all intents and purposes, looks like Pesach, but it isn't Pesach for us. What is it? It is the day after Pesach when we resume Parshat HaShavua, the weekly portion, which was for us last week, Acharei. Outside of Israel, there are special Torah readings both for every day of Pesach. That means all 7 days like we have, and for the eighth day as well. Departing from the weekly reading, in their case, when I say that I mean outside of Israel, two Shabbatot in a row. The rest of the world will be reading Parshat Acharei this Shabbat. And we will remain out of sync for 15 weeks. That's a long time. When it is not a two Adar year, but Pesach is Friday night, then we have a much closer opportunity to rejoin, to get back into sync. And that is by taking the double portion of Bahar B'chukotai that they read outside of Israel on that week and splitting it into Bahar and B'chukotai. So after that, namely Parshat Bamidbar, pre-Shavuot, pre the day that we celebrate receiving the Torah, pre the day that symbolizes the unity of the Jewish people, we are back together. Not this year. The other situation, just for your information, is when Shavuot is Friday here, and outside of Israel, it is Friday Shabbat. So outside of Israel, Parshat HaShavuot is skipped for 1 week. Here in Israel, we don't lose anything in Parshat HaShavuot because Shavuot itself, 1 day, can never be a Shabbat. And we have regular Torah reading. And we go out of sync until Chukat Balak, which is what is doubled up in Chutz La'aretz to catch up with us. So, that's the background. Many, many people have asked me, because they know that I like the calendar and I play around with statistics and numbers and everything like that, how come we here in Israel, didn't take the opportunity, in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, why didn't they take the opportunity this Shabbat to combine Acharei and Kedoshim, which are combined in other years, and that would bring us back in sync for next week already. Or, if for some reason not that, you've got Tazria Metzora, same, what am I talking about? That was before, forget that. You have Acharei Kedoshim, and then the next available one would be Baharin B'chukotai, but we still read those separately, and sort of they do that in Chutz La'aretz. So we remain out of sync, one Sedra ahead of the rest of the world, until, as I mentioned, summertime when we get up to Matot Maseh, which is a double Sedra in Chutz La'aretz, which we can separate. Why don't we do it the other way? Why don't we double up something? Sorry. Why don't they double up something in order to catch up, rather than we splitting a much later Sedra to let them catch up? I hope the question is cleared, even though I flubbed it a couple of times. The answer is that the system of Torah reading, which includes seven pairs of Sedras, which are sometimes doubled up and sometimes read separately, four of which pairs are responsible for adding the extra Shabbatot readings for years that have an extra month in them, Adar II, that all was created in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel. And at that time, I don't know exactly when, we in Israel, can't say we because it was way before my time, were on a three-year cycle of Torah reading and did not have the system that was used in Chutz La'aretz. Somewhere along the line, it was adopted universally around the world, including in Israel. And we, as well as Chutz La'aretz, go through a yearly cycle of Torah reading from Bereshit, right after Simchas Torah, all the way around the year to Simchat Torah when we finish with Vizot HaBracha and begin the beginning of Bereshit again. That system calls for Acharei and Kedoshim, Bahar and Bechukotai to be separate in a Shana Mu'uberet, in a leap year. So they will mess things up in the system if they were to combine and speed up. We in Israel have to slow down. And the only way to slow down is by taking a double, which is read in Chutz La'aretz, and separating them. So you will see on the calendar that our Kedoshim is with their Acharei, and our Emor is with their Kedoshim, and on and on and on, until they read Pinchas, we read Matot, they read Matot Maseh, we read Maseh, and we're back in sync. I hope that clarifies things, even though it was a long explanation, and maybe a little confusing, especially when I had to correct myself. So that's that, I hope. Now comes the quandary. I really don't have good statistics as to how many people in Israel listen to the show and how many people in Chutz La'aretz. I really should probably say I'm broadcasting from Israel, from Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah U'Devar Hashem Yerushalayim, and everything else that goes with that. And people outside of Israel have to adjust. So if I'm going to talk about Kedoshim, somebody's going to get confused outside of Israel and say, wait a minute, I thought we were reading Acharei this Shabbat. You are. But Acharei was last week. I didn't do a show for last week. It was during Pesach. And didn't get to speak about Acharei. I really have an important meeting coming up, and I'm not going to be able to do much more here than just give a brief outline, especially statistics-wise and mitzvot-wise. Parshat Acharei contains 28 mitzvot, 22 of which are positive, meaning thou shalt do something. 26 are prohibitions. Many of those prohibitions deal with forbidden sexual relationships. But the fact is that it's an overwhelming number of prohibitions compared to the mitzvot aseh, the positive mitzvot. In addition, the three chapters that make up Acharei. The first chapter we're very familiar with from Yom Kippur because it's the Torah reading of Yom Kippur morning. Different tune, same reading. The last third we're familiar with for the Torah reading of the afternoon of Yom Kippur. And only chapter 17 has nothing to do with Yom Kippur and is not read on either of those occasions, on either morning or afternoon on Yom Kippur or whatever. In any event, that's a very, very quick overview of Acharei. And Kedoshim, I can't do justice to either of them, but I want to mention Kedoshim for the following reason. Again, as you know from Torah Tidbits and from Torah Tidbits Audio and the website, which I hope you visit sometimes, which is ttidbits.com, and it has been updated for this week already. Has a lot of new features on it, so I invite you to join to click on it. Ttidbits.com. Two T's at the beginning of the word tidbits.com. So those who are familiar with me know that I love statistics and the counting of mitzvot specifically. And Kedoshim has 51 mitzvot. It is not the leader in the Torah of mitzvot. Ki Teitzei is with 74. Emor, next week, has 63 mitzvot. Re'e has 55. Mishpatim has 53. And in fifth place comes Kedoshim. However, Kedoshim is a very small sedra. It has only 64 verses, 64 psukim, and to pack in 51 mitzvot in there is very, very heavy. In addition, there are a bunch more of the mitzvot which are mentioned but have already been counted in Acharei. So, first statement is, Kedoshim is the most mitzvah-dense of all the sedras of the Torah. If you then include other mitzvot that are mentioned in it, it gets even more dense. I don't have a good statistic on that, but I'll leave that as a point of pondering. But the most important part of that is the sedra begins with a command from God. Kedoshim tihyu, be holy. And with that kind of command, it's not the same as eat matzah in the evening. You come to the Pesach Seder, and you get a portion of matzah, and you eat it in fulfillment of the mitzvah to eat matzah at that night. Easy. Count the Omer. Last night was 12. You have a command to count the Omer for 49 nights. And last night we said, Hayom, Shneimasar, Yom, Shehem, Shavua Echad, V'chamisha Yamim La'Omer. Done. Be holy. What am I supposed to do? Does it mean that I should find a mountaintop and wear a simple cloth robe and shave my head and cross my legs and ponder the universe? No. The definition of and method of be holy is clear. It is clear because the words that follow it in the 64 short psukim contain 51 mitzvot out of the 613. So do you want to know how to be holy? Do the mitzvot. But there's more than that. Don't just go through the motions. Why are you doing that? Because I have to. Why are you doing that? Because the Shulchan Aruch says so. A person needs to develop, and it's not easy, but it's good. A person needs to develop an attitude about mitzvot, an enthusiasm about mitzvot, a pride, not an arrogance, but a pride in mitzvot, and in the feeling that each of us has the capability of becoming partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, partners with God, through the fulfillment of His Torah and mitzvot. On that note, I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, No, I have to tell you also that the Shabbos we bench Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Rosh Chodesh Iyar is the next day, which is Sunday and Monday, 2 day Rosh Chodesh, because Nisan has only has 30 days. And next week, Mirtz Hashem, I'll find some time to do a show, and we'll talk about Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzma'ut. In the meantime, I repeat, Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, L'Hishtameah.